This is the Game Misconduct Podcast with Don LaGreca.
And welcome to the Monday edition of Game Misconduct. I am Don LaGreca. Of course, Monday, we're always joined by E.J. Raddick from NHL Now on the NHL Network from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. How are you, buddy?
I am good, Don. I'd be better if they didn't disqualify my horse the other day in the Derby, because I would have had a couple hundred bucks. But, you know, that's the way it goes. Some people suffer, other people benefit. Look, Keith Jones ended up winning a lot of money.
No, apparently that's not the way it goes, because it's never happened in the 145 years of the race. I mean, listen, I'm not going to pretend to be a horse racing fan. I'm not. I didn't see the race. I obviously heard about it. I heard about it because all people are over Twitter, apoplectic. You know, where's the Bruins Blue Jackets game, because it's getting moved off of NBC and all that stuff. But here's the thing, all right, because we can kind of relate it to hockey. We go through the goaltender interference and all that.
Yeah.
And it was it a goal? Was he offside? Was he not offside? Was it goaltender interference? Wasn't? But if there was a goaltender interference in the game tonight, and it was the first ever in the 145 years of the event, I think people would be a little nuts. I mean, so I literally did not have a horse in the race, but explain to me how something can happen for the first time ever.
Well, now we have a lot more cameras and a lot more technology, and you know, that's what happens. I mean, I know I can only say this. I mean, in a 20 horse, because people were saying, well, if this was a race at Belmont on a Tuesday, this would be, you know, would be no question the horse would be taken down. But on a Tuesday at Belmont, you don't have a 20 horse field with 180,000 people like screaming from all angles. So it's a different environment, and I would dare say that there's been fouls in every Kentucky Derby race ever run that's concluded a field of more than a few. And, you know, this was something that you could see. And, you know, I think it impacted the winner, the eventual winner of the race who was DQ'd, Maximum Security. It impacted him in a negative way, and he still went on to win the race. So I thought the best horse finished across the finish line first. It did impact two other horses, the number one horse and the number 18 horse. It did not, in my view, impact the 20 horse who was named the winner.
Right.
But, you know, this is, you know, there was something amiss at the top of the stretch there when they were making the turn. The horse did come out a little bit. But again, as I say, I mean, it's a crowded field, and these horses are banging into each other all the time. So the stewards did what they did. The people who had the tickets like I did for the 7 horse, you know, ripped them up, and the people who had tickets for the 20 horse are still celebrating probably days later, because at 65-1, you probably made a little bit of a bundle for yourself.
We move on. And we've got a lot to get to even before the playoffs.
I will say one other quick thing, John, is that they have now opened up a little bit of a Pandora's box, and we know something about that from hockey, from the offside challenges and from some of the other things that we thought would be, oh, and also just once in a while, the egregious play. And as we learned that it was actually being challenged, or there were a lot more plays that were actually offside than we even imagined.
Sure.
And I would think going forward in the future history of the Kentucky Derby, I would imagine there might be more claims of foul in the future. So we will see how that plays out down the road.
So much to get to even before we get to the playoffs, because we got a lot of news breaking here. Ken Holland apparently on the verge of becoming the Edmonton Oilers' next general manager, after obviously moved out with Detroit with the entrance of Steve Yzerman. As the time of this recording, no ink to paper yet, but the reports are that he will be the next general manager of the Oilers. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, they made him a really good financial offer. 5 years times $5 million per season, so a $25 million offer is, I think, a terrific offer. I'm sure the discussion was that Kenny is going to have as much autonomy as a general manager can have within the process. I mean, you're not going to get – people say you get full autonomy. Well, if the owner decides he doesn't want to do something, I mean, you're not doing it. That's just the way that goes. But I'm sure Kenny was promised quite a bit of the ability to make decisions on all things with the organization. And, you know, as we talked about, I think when we talked about Steve Yzerman thing coming on, this is another case of a Lou Lamoriello or a Jim Rutherford who was kind of moved aside for someone else in those particular spots, and guys who really still enjoy really having their hands on things. And so Kenny Holland got offered, was given a very good offer, and given probably the idea that he's going to be able to do things the way he wants to. He's a Western Canadian kid. He inherits the best player in the game in Connor McDavid, or at least the most offensively productive, and he inherits another good player there as well, and Leon Draisaitl. So they got a lot of work to do, but you know, it's somebody obviously Kenny wanted to work, and it was a very good financial offer for him. So he goes likely going to go to Edmonton, and you know, we'll see how it plays out for him.
Yeah, I think it's the right move when you consider who's available, and they certainly were a rudderless ship there for a long time as far as trying to find the right person to direct this franchise. Even though we can question some of the talent in some of the areas, they have way too much talent to miss the playoffs back-to-back years the way they did, especially not feeding off of going to the second round of the playoffs just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, they have high-end talent, certainly from McDavid and Draisaitl, and you know. But the year they went to the playoffs, I think it was largely on the back of Cam Talbot. I mean, he was so good that year, it could have easily been a Vezina or a Hart Trophy winner. I mean, he was really good. He played a lot of games for them that year, if you remember, Donnie. I think he played near 70 games.
Oh, yeah, easily.
Which we don't see that much anymore. So that was really the biggest reason why they got to the postseason that season. Talbot hadn't been really as good the last couple of years, and then they've made a change there, and he eventually was traded, and I know they have Koskinen, who really hasn't been the answer either. So there's a lot of work to be done there for sure with that roster. They're hoping that some of these younger players that they have in their minor league system, like a Caleb Jones, for example, Seth Jones' younger brother, a defenseman, Yamamoto, they drafted a couple of years ago as a first-round pick. Hoping some of these kind of guys can come in and help their roster. But they haven't drafted and developed very well outside of the first picks that they've had, and that is in a large part why they're in the situation they're in.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah, 73 appearances for Talbot in that 16-17 season. 142 games, so a pretty incredible year.
Yeah, he had a great year. He could, like I said, he could have easily been a winner of the Vezina Trophy and could have easily been a candidate for the Hart Trophy. He was so valuable to that.
Also, Alain Vigneault, we know, is the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers, and he got himself a couple of nice lieutenants, Mike Yeo and Michelle Therrien. So it's not too often that you see a coach go out and get former head coach assistants, but I guess he signed a long-term contract, so I guess the biggest negative of bringing on guys with head coaching experience is you basically hire guys that could possibly take your job, but at this stage, Vigneault, with a first year of a long-term contract, I guess just wants to have the best people around him.
Yeah, and there's a connection for Chuck Fletcher, who's the general manager in Philadelphia now. I mean, Michael Therrien was in Pittsburgh, and Chuck was, you know, working under Ray Shero in Pittsburgh before he went to Minnesota. So there's a connection there. Alain Vigneault and Michel Therrien have, I'm sure that they are well acquainted. Mike Yeo also was in Pittsburgh around that same time, and Chuck also had Mike Yeo as a coach in Minnesota. So I think there's a lot of familiarity there with those guys. Apparently, they're keeping Ian LaPerriere on as well. Good for him because he's a good guy and a hardworking assistant coach. So, we'll see what happens with Philly. But it's odd. The Philadelphia Flyers now have a pretty large influence from teams that are rival to theirs. I mean, from the Penguins, certainly, with Fletcher's background and Therrien's background and Yeo's background, and from the Rangers with Alain Vigneault. So we'll see how it plays out in Philly. They've got a pretty good roster. Looks like they're going to have a goalie going forward in Carter Hart. So some interesting times. And I feel bad for Ricky Wilson there, who was let go today. He's been a really good assistant coach for many, many years, going back to his time in Dallas when they won a Stanley Cup there, and really good with young defensemen. So we'll see if he turns up somewhere else.
So the theme throughout the second round of the playoffs is, oh my God, we could see all four wild card teams make it to the conference final. And when it's all said and done, we might only see one, right? Carolina ended up completing the sweep of the Islanders, and we'll get to them in a second because the story has just been magical. But San Jose's up 3-2, Detroit and St. Louis tied at 3, Dallas and St. Louis tied at 3, and then of course we've got Boston on the verge of disposing of Columbus, although John Tortorella vows there'll be a Game 7 back in Boston, and that was pretty entertaining over the weekend. But really, so you look at the upsets and how crazy things are, you know, if we get a Boston-San Jose final, EJ, it's you kind of have chalk, but you also have the upsets. You get like kind of the best of both worlds here, because if you get San Jose and Boston, I think a lot of people probably at the beginning of the year wouldn't have been surprised by that.
No, I agree. I mean, I said that, you know, the San Jose Sharks were a team that was certainly on my radar at the very start of the season. And, you know, the Boston Bruins are one of the, you know, they're one of the better teams in the league this year. So, yeah, I mean, if it ends up that way, it'll be kind of an odd climax to a playoff run where there were a lot of upsets. But again, I go back to the same thing. The league is so darn close right now, and it doesn't take much to get the edge on a team in a 4-7 game series when you really drill down on all their weaknesses and how you match up against them. But we got a long way to go for all those teams because, yeah, they all have to win one game, but, you know, those games can be hard to win. As we saw
Vegas in the
last round, for example, had a 3-2 lead on home ice in game 6, couldn't nail it down, and they had a big 3-0 lead in game 7 on the road in the third period and couldn't nail it down. So it's tight, and we'll see what happens the rest of the way with these three series that have gone very deep.
Hey, we got 3 game 7s in the first round. We might get 3 game 7s in the second round here. So let's see. We definitely have one with Dallas and St. Louis, and I'm not surprised by this at all. I do feel bad. Not that they would have won the game anyway, EJ, because they were trailing at the time. But that third goal was just a killer, right? It kind of catches Bishop on the shoulder, and I don't know what you can really do about it, right? I mean, he's hurt. Clearly he's down. He made no effort to get back up. But usually you let it play out. I don't really think that Dallas has a kick coming, although you do feel bad that that goal was literally scored because you had a goaltender that just could not get up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Dallas has made a case.
No, I'm just
getting really, but listen, for me, I can only say this, Donnie. For me, I would say two things. If I was the referee, I would have blown the whistle because I think there's enough discretion in there when a guy is seriously, when you think there might be a serious injury, to blow the whistle. He was hit with a shot up high. I don't know if Chris Rooney, maybe his vision is way better than mine from the corner than I was on television, but I wasn't sure if he got hit in the neck. I wasn't exactly sure where he got hit until I saw the replay. All I know is he got hit very high near his head, and then he went down, and he was kind of, you know, it's rolling in pain. So it was pretty obvious that he was in severe discomfort or distress. And when the goalie is down in that spot, it's different than when one of the players is down. When the goalie is down, if you don't blow the whistle there, somebody could have teed up another slapper and hit him in the back of the head.
Right.
Playing on the ice. So, you know, I don't know. I thought, you know, Dave Reed, who's my colleague here at NHL Network, had a good thought on it. He's played in almost 1,000 NHL games, regular season games, plus playoffs, and his whole life he's been playing hockey. And he said, you know, I've never seen a situation where the goalie went down like that where the whistle wasn't blown. So, you know, at the end of the day, it happened quick. It was only 4 seconds between when he got hit, I think, and when the puck ends up in the net. And really smart of Tomas Steen to throw it back to the net, and a great play by Jaden Schwartz to get a stick on it. All I can really say in that spot is I haven't, like Dave Reed, I have never seen a situation where the goalie was down and looked to be in distress where the whistle wasn't blown. And speaking for myself, if that whistle would have been in my hand, I would have blown it right there based on what I saw. But that's not to say that, you know, it didn't get blown and St. Louis scored, and that's life.
Yeah.
I think that Dallas has taken the right approach here. Jim Montgomery has taken, I think, the absolute right approach because he's got to get focused on getting his team ready for a game 7. The St. Louis Blues, you know, they started out gangbusters in game 6. They didn't play well for the second part of the first period in the second period, but once they got the lead, they really didn't give Dallas much. So I think Jim is handling it right by just getting focused on the next game. And you know what? If it goes at the other end and Jordan Binnington gets hit with a shot and he's laying there, I'm sure Jim Montgomery's going to want them not to blow the whistle in that circumstance.
Right. It's great points by Reed, and you look at how sensitive they are to goaltenders possibly getting injured. I mean, the traffic in front of the net, if a mask is lost during the course of play, the whistle is instantaneously blown, doesn't matter what's going on, because obviously the goaltender would be in peril without a mask on.
Yeah.
But I don't really see how it would have benefited Bishop to fake the injury.
Yeah,
right.
No, you know, not in that case.
Yeah, I think you have to, kind of, as you said, use your judgment of, in that case, I don't see where he would have faked the injury, how that would have benefited, because he would have put himself in position to be able to make the save. So,
spot. Like I said, he could have been, like, he was laying there in pain.
Yeah.
And he was not able to defend himself.
Sure.
So if another shot would have come in, I mean, he could have been injured on the follow-up.
Absolutely. So, once you see him go, because goaltenders will go down, because when I first saw the angle, I would thought maybe he could have tried to draw a goaltender interference. Maybe he had gotten clipped by, then you saw the one angle that nobody was even close to him, but there was the one angle from the shot from the blue line where you thought maybe he could have gotten clipped by a player or maybe somebody on the Blues and he was trying to sell a goaltender interference, but clearly from the other angle, it's like, I really don't know how it would have benefited to fake it. So I do think they got it wrong, but at the same time, as you said, Dallas is not complaining. It happens, and not sure they would have won the game anyway, although it could have been a little bit more of an interesting close. Now you got a game seven there, which is no surprise because those teams are just so even. Let's go to the Islanders. They get swept. Was it just the fifth time since expansion, I think it was, or ninth time overall, that a team has swept a series only to get swept in the very next round in a best of seven, which is crazy. But we talked about it last week. This is a machine right now. This is a team that's on a roll, and it doesn't seem to matter who. It doesn't seem to matter where. I don't know when it's going to all come together. And I don't want to take anything away from their talent, EJ, because they do have talent. But you can't tell me it's conference final talent, especially when they lose Mrazek and going through some of the injuries that they've gone through. They're just a cohesive unit, knows how to play. They know how to protect the lead. You know, they'll fall into that almost sometimes a 1-4 just to be able to protect that lead. But, you know, I don't want to sit here and talk about what happened to the Islanders. That would be disrespectful to Carolina because I do think they deserve to win the series. But does this ever come to an end? Because at this point, they just seem like a scary team to have to play. I mean, Columbus and Boston, whoever wins that series is going to have their hands full.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the Carolina Hurricanes really believe in one another right now. And when guys get hurt, it's the next man up mentality and other guys step up. And I mean, the bottom line is that whether it's been Mrazek or McElhinney, they've had good goaltending. So the goalies have kept them in the games and given them chances to win. So that's the first thing we look at, right? Then you look at that group of defensemen. I mean, Slavin is having an unbelievable, you know, playoff run in 11 games. He's got 11 points. He's a plus 8. He's playing, you know, almost 27 minutes a night. So, I mean, he's been a force out there. Brett Pesce, who's a New York kid, is playing really well. You know, he's another guy up over 23 minutes. He's got the 6 assists, plus 8 as a player. So, you know, he's been, that's a great local story, too. A kid from Tarrytown, New York, who played his youth hockey in New Jersey, and now he's found his way into the National Hockey League and playing well on defense. Then you have Justin Falk back there. You know, you have Cal DeHaan, who they picked up from the Islanders last year, is a back-end defender. Dougie Hamilton is kind of a back-end defender who was higher up in other lineups in his career. They lost Trevor Van Riemsdyk to injury, but they've added Hayden Fleury, who was a high draft pick, and they're not using him all that much. But, you know, so they've got good goaltending and good defense. And then when you look at through the middle of their team, I mean, Jordan Staal and Sebastian Aho as centers, I mean, Staal is a big, strong, hard-to-play-against guy who's got Stanley Cup-winning experience, and Aho is a terrific young player with a lot of upside in his game and skill. And, you know, this is a pretty good group, and they really believe in one another. They're really taking care of all the details in the game, the back-checking, the short shifts, everything that it takes to win, they're trying to nail down. My concern for them would be my same concern that I had for the Islanders after they swept in round number one is, you know, will there be a little bit of rust that changes things for them if we see Boston and Columbus go to a game seven? That wouldn't take place until Wednesday. You probably don't start till Friday. So it's probably a week of idle time for the Hurricanes if, you know, Boston and Columbus go seven. So outside of that, this has been a really good story and a team that's playing really well and really believes in one another.
Yeah, and the whole jerk story, I think, has kind of been fun and, you know, a bunch of jerks from Don Cherry, so they've been able to feed off of that, too. So it's just a really interesting story. It's been fun. We've seen this from Carolina before. It seems like whenever they make the playoffs, they make a run, right? It's just incredible.
They do,
02, 06, 09, and now making it back to the conference final here in 2019, 10 years after the last time they made a playoff appearance. And, you know, we talked about the change in venue with the Islanders, and a lot of Islander fans are trying to make a stink out of that. They only scored the one goal in the two games in Brooklyn. It's so rare, if ever. I think I saw 1951, the Knicks had to change from the Garden to the Armory because the circus was in town during the course of a series. It's so rare to see a team change their home venue in the middle of a series. Do you think it played any kind of factor at all?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to say the Islanders lost the series and got swept because the team moved, but I will say this. I mean, that kind of thing directly impacted each and every player. I mean, these guys all were used to one routine, and you know, now they had to settle back into another routine, which they are familiar with, but is a little bit more time-consuming and taxing as you go through the day to have to, you know, plan your day differently. I mean, when they were at the Coliseum, they obviously live out there. If they wanted to skate in the morning, they could skate at the facility. And then, you know, again, it was their day was pretty easy. The day of going and playing in Brooklyn, it's just added things to worry about and added things in the day of each and every player. And so, I mean, it had some impact. And the Islanders, you know, let's face it, they were close in the series. I mean, game one is scoreless into overtime. They make a Cal Clutterbuck makes a bad turnover at his own blue line, and the puck goes the other way, and it's all of a sudden a good bounce off the dasher, and it's 1-0, and Carolina wins the first game. They get a couple of quick goals in game two, and, you know, they hang on for a 2-1 win in that game. And, you know, even in game three in Carolina, it was basically a one-goal game as well. So, you know, for me, I mean, these games were, the first three games were certainly close. And, you know, the Islanders just couldn't find a way to be opportunistic, and Carolina Hurricanes were able to.
All right, Avalanche up against it tonight, along with the Blue Jackets. Any thoughts on who's got the best chance to close out the series tonight, the Sharks or the Bruins?
Well, I mean, I think they're both – it's going to be a struggle. Both of the series have been tight. I mean, the Sharks have that experience advantage, I would say, over the Avalanche, but and it's really a matchup game there. It looked like Peter DeBoer was able to get Vlasic and Burns on the ice a lot against McKinnon in game number five, and I think San Jose probably played one of their better games in the series, and they still ended up winning 2-1. And you know, the Avalanche had some chances late in the game, so I would imagine the matchups will be a little different in Colorado with Jared Bednar having that last change. And you know, as far as Boston and Columbus goes, I mean, that's been a nasty, hard series, and the goalies have both been good. But give Tuukka Rask a lot of credit. He's been playing terrific, and he's made the big saves when need be, and so that's why they have the lead. But, you know, I would suspect tonight Columbus in that building, if they can get the lead in that building and kind of, you know, push Boston on their heels a little bit, they'd be in a better position to force a game seven. So I guess to answer your question, I probably feel like Columbus has a little bit better chance, but I think both of the home teams have a good chance to win tonight.
All right, you ready for some tweets?
Let's go.
All right, Chris says, hey guys, to follow up on last podcast with Nazem Kadri, does it make sense for the Flyers to pursue a trade in exchange for Gostisbehere? For the Flyers, Kadri has the same cap hit, fits a need at two center, and can be replaced in 3 years with a development of Patrick and Frost.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, let's face it, Toronto will be looking for help on the blue line. I think Toronto would prefer a right shot, and I think Toronto would probably prefer someone that's a little bit more well-rounded to their game, as opposed to Gostisbehere, who's more of a, you know, he's like a really power play specialist and a really good offensive defenseman. I think with Riley there in Toronto, you know, he's somebody that can fill a lot of that stuff for the Leafs. I think they're looking for more of a right shot guy, but you know, I think you're in the ballpark with that kind of idea. I think if Toronto's going to move Kadri, and I'm already on the record of saying I would, then I would be looking to get some help on the blue line.
David says, for someone that didn't watch the Hurricanes make their runs to the finals in 02 and 06, how do these teams compare to the current crop of jerks that just find ways to overcome the odds and keep moving and keep winning?
Well, those previous Hurricanes teams, I mean, they had some pretty high-end players. I mean, the coach of the team now, Roddy Brind'Amour, was on those teams. And, you know, the 06 team had Eric Staal in his young prime at that point. And
they had 112 points that year. I mean, they weren't as good as Buffalo. I think they took advantage of the Buffalo injuries. But, you know, they had 112 points. That was a good team.
Yeah. Yes, it was a good team, and they had a lot of that was coming out of the work stoppage too, where I think the rules had changed, and I think Carolina with Peter Laviolette that year, I think their game really fit into what the league was in that particular season. And, they got, remember, if you go back in 06, they lost the first two games against Montreal in round number one at home in the, at the jerk store. They lost both of those. They were both wild games, I think. And then Laviolette, I think at that point, made the move to Cam Ward because Marty Gerber had been the starter. Cam Ward was a rookie that year. And the rest, as they say, is history because they were able to get some footing in Montreal and end up winning that series. And I agree with you. Buffalo really got dinged up on the blue line, and that impacted them. I remember, I think it was Brian Campbell threw one over the glass.
Yeah, that was killer.
Penalty that ended up being a power play goal for Carolina that gave them that game. Then they had the crazy final with the Edmonton Oilers, with Chris Pronger on the Oilers in that particular season. So, that was, I thought, those teams had some more veteran players, more established players, really high-end players. It's a little bit of a different group, but this group here, as I mentioned earlier, that defense is a really good defense for the league that we have now. So, they're finding ways, but I'm not going to sit here and say they don't have talented players. They got some good players on this team. And Rod Brind'Amour has been able to stir the drink just correctly in this case.
And that 0-2 team, I just looked it up. They won their division, but they had 91 points, so it was kind of an upset. Of course, Paul Maurice was the head coach of that team. They had the CBC line, if you remember. That's Archer, right. Zerbe, yes, had basically mattresses for goalie pads. And
that's right.
He looked like
he played well early in the playoffs. They kind of split for a while. I think Weeksy played well early.
Yeah.
And then Urbe came in, and he was their guy for much of the playoffs. But, they had Ron Francis, I believe, was on that team. And I remember they went into Detroit and won game one in overtime, and that was a shocker because the Red Wings had such a great team that year. I think that was the team that had the 9 Hall of Famers on it, something along those lines. I mean, it was all kinds of high-end talent. And Carolina was able to steal game one, and then I think game three went to double overtime.
They did, yeah.
Before the Red Wings were able to win, and if Carolina had found a way to win that one, who knows?
Things
would have gone.
Just taking a look at their roster, they had some pretty decent players. Martin Gélinas was on that team.
Yep.
Here's a little trivia question. It might blow you away. Who led the playoffs in goals? It's two different players. Who led the playoffs in goals for Carolina that year and points that year in the postseason for the 0-2 Hurricanes?
Okay. Let's see. Would Brind'Amour have been one of them or no?
Brind'Amour would not be one of them.
Okay. Well, you're going to have to tell
me. Right.
I mean, Ron Francis on that team. You had Eric Cole on that team, I think. I'm trying to think of the CBC.
Yeah, I was just looking because I remember the CBC line, but I forget who was on because I thought it was Brind'Amour, Battaglia, and Cole. But that doesn't make sense for CBC. So I'm trying to remember how that matched up. But yeah, points was playoff points was Ron Francis, who had 16 points. Goals was Jeff O'Neill. Jeff O'Neill had 8 goals.
Radio star.
And you know what? Bates Battaglia had 14 points. He was second on the team in postseason points. So he had to be on that CBC line then.
Yes. Hey, listen, it was a heck of a run. It's funny to look back, Don, at seasons like that where, and think about the players that were on those teams because it's people that you didn't expect, in some of those circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. So you never know what kind of runs you can be on, but this Hurricanes team is going to be among one of the biggest surprises of all time. Brian G. says, will the Islanders re-sign all of their UFAs?
Well, I don't think they're going to sign all of them. I mean, I think that Lou Lamoriello spoke today at their breakup day, and he spoke in glowing terms about Anders Lee. So I think that their captain is very, very high on their list, and I assume he's going to get re-signed. He likes it there. They like him, and I'm sure they'll work something out. Brock Nelson, I think, is probably on their list to try to keep as well. Although, I don't know if he's going to be patting anybody on the head next year during games. One of the weirder stories I've seen in NHL playoffs where a guy pats the goalie on the head after a goal is scored.
I didn't buy his excuse either. He didn't want to run into him.
It was just a weird play. But you know what I didn't really like either is Dougie Hamilton patting Brock Nelson on the head
during the handshake,
line because I, especially this is the thing. They had a game, and they had four more periods that I believe were played in that series after that play by Nelson. It happened, I believe, late in the second period.
Yeah.
That play happened in game three. And if Dougie Hamilton was that upset by it, there was plenty of time for Dougie Hamilton to let Brock Nelson know how he felt. And when you think about game four, you had a full 20 minutes of play where the series was basically over at that point. And, you know, not to say Dougie Hamilton needed to do anything crazy, but if he wanted to confront Brock Nelson physically, he had every opportunity to do it. But instead, he patted him on the head in the handshake line. So I don't know why Brock Nelson did it to begin with. I thought it was kind of silly. I've interviewed Brock Nelson before. He seems like a pretty, you know, Minnesota kid, doesn't say too much. So, I mean, I have no idea what was going on the ice and why he did that. But I think if Doug Hamilton had such a big problem with it, he's probably could. He had a lot of opportunity over the next 80 minutes of series time to make those feelings known Mr. Nelson, and he didn't do it. So that, you know, and this is a guy that was basically cowering away from Alex Ovechkin in round number one. So for me, I was, you know, the act itself was kind of silly by Brock Nelson, but I thought Dougie Hamilton's response was equally strange and, you know, in my view, coward, to be honest with you. But at any rate, that's that.
All right, we got
I think Nelson's going to sign. After that, they're going to probably try to sign Leonard, too. But I think, you know, Lou is probably looking at a lot of things when it comes to goaltenders. And, you know, I think Leonard is probably high on their list. But if, you know, Sergei Bobrovsky is someone that has shown an interest.
You're right.
In coming to the island, I think they would entertain that as well. So we'll see. But I would think those guys for sure. I don't think Jordan Eberle will be coming back, and I'm not sure about Val Filppula.
Hey, and I'm glad you brought up Bobrovsky, and we'll close it out with this. And I mean, no disrespect to their goaltending. They paired for a Jennings, okay? I'm just not sure if either of those two guys are like cup championship goalies, honestly. I mean, Leonard's been a great story. He's up for the Vezina, but I'm not sure that's somebody you build around, and Greiss the same thing. I think they're nice goaltenders, and they could possibly win a cup with the right team in front of them. But if you got a chance to upgrade, I still look at that as an area that you can upgrade. And if a Bobrovsky wants to sign with you, I am not going to shy away because of how well Greiss and Leonard played this year.
Yeah, I think that's the proper approach. And I would say that one other thing, too, is I think what we learned in this second round is that Greiss is the clear number two.
Yes.
Because if there was ever an opportunity to make a goaltending change in a playoff series, it was after game three. It wasn't a knock on Leonard. I think just to change up your team and the fact that Greiss had played so well against Carolina, not only this past year, but he had a winning record in his career against the Hurricanes, whereas I don't think Robin Leonard has ever beaten the Hurricanes. I thought that was the time to do it. So it really told me when they started that game with Leonard that Robin Leonard was the clear number one, despite the fact that they had basically split the games almost down the middle during the regular season. I mean, Leonard played 46, Greiss played 43. Their statistics were almost identical. And yet, when push came to shove after three games of the series, there was an unwillingness to go to Greiss. So, you know, if you're wondering, you know, moving forward, I would think it tells you that they viewed Robin Leonard as the clear number one and Greiss as the number two, despite the games played situation this year.
I still would have done it anyway, I think.
I would have done it, too. I would have made a change. I would have gone to, I said it the other day, I would have gone to Greiss in game four just to shake things up, no reflection of the way Leonard played, and maybe because I can remember, you know, an Islander team that was down 3-0 against the Pittsburgh Penguins in 1975 when Al Arbor decided to go to Chico Rush in game four as opposed to Billy Smith. And Chico responded with a 1-0 with a win in game four, and they ended up winning the series in 7-1-0 in game seven. So, you know, maybe that's just me being around for too long to remember such a thing, but, you know, I thought it was probably time to take a chance with Greiss. And in the end, he ended up having to come in anyway, but by then it was too late.
Yeah, it was way too late. All right, tonight a couple of game sixes, Blue Jackets and Bruins, Sharks and the Avalanche, so a lot to go over tomorrow. We will talk to you again on Monday when we'll have everything set for the conference finals.
All right, who are your picks for tonight, Donnie? Who do you like?
I'm going to go with Torts, believing in his team. I think the Blue Jackets will force a game seven. I think the Sharks finish it off tonight.
Okay, all right. Well, that's good. That's interesting because it's tight, so we'll see how it goes.
All right, we'll talk to you next week.
All right, buddy.
All right, that's the great EJ Raddick. So 7 o'clock, the first game in Columbus. 10 o'clock, the late game Eastern time from Colorado. Avalanche and the Sharks. Avalanche and the Blue Jackets both facing elimination. Hopefully we can get three game sevens out of the four here in the second round and set things up as Carolina twiddles their thumbs and waits for their opponent, which may not come until later on this week. Definitely won't come until later on this week, as Wednesday would be the potential game seven if Columbus does indeed win tonight. Back with you again tomorrow. Thanks for all the tweets. At Don LaGreca, hashtag Game Misconduct, the way to get in touch with me. Back with you again tomorrow. This is the Monday edition of Game Misconduct.
Thanks for listening to the Game Misconduct podcast. Looking for more Don LaGreca? Hear him on the Michael K. Show weekdays from 3 to 7 p.m. on 98.7 ESPN in New York. And worldwide on the ESPN app. And don't forget to subscribe to the Game Misconduct podcast on the ESPN app, Google Play Music, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.